key sites in the history of Iran are already being destroyed, regardless of what happens tonight.
These monuments become locations of memory.
I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Today, going back to the dawn of Persian civilization for perspective on that loss. Also, Taiwan has its eye on what's happening in the Middle East and is planning accordingly.
Taiwan will feel a lot more exposed at this time and be very wary of any potential military buildup that China might actually undertake in the near future.
And in India, our reporter gets a close-up look at an elephant robot.
Head, ear, eyes, tail.
What's his name?
Not yet decided.
These robots are helping solve a serious problem. That's all ahead. Today on The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman.
And I'm Carolyn Beeler. 8 p.m. Eastern Time. That is when President Trump has threatened to destroy Iran's bridges and power plants if the country did not make a deal to reopen the Strait of Hormuz. A threat he reiterated today, saying, quote, an entire civilization will die tonight.
In response, Iranian official Alireza Rahimi issued a video message calling on civilians to form a human chain around power plants. He specifically urged youth, athletes, artists, students, and professors to defend the plants, which he called Iran's national capital, saying they belong to the future of Iran and to Iranian youth, regardless of political persuasion. Gather, he instructs, to tell the world that attacking public infrastructure is a war crime.
Today, those human chains began to form. Iranian state media released video showing crowds of people, seemingly hundreds of them, lining up with flags and singing nationalist songs as they encircled the Khazaroun power plant.
Strikes and rocket attacks have not paused for negotiations. The U.S. and Israel hit a key oil terminal off the coast of Iran, and a missile strike in Tehran destroyed a synagogue in the city. Trump has now told Fox News that he might push back the deadline.
But plenty of damage has already been done to Iranian civilization, past and present.
I've been following that most closely. As a historian, of course, that is what I deal with.
That's Turaj Deryi, director of the Center for Persian Studies at University of California, Irvine. He kicks things off for us today with some perspective on Persian civilization and the pride many Iranians take in its legacy.
Persia has contributed to world civilization in several interesting and important manners. It's one of the earliest locations that civilization comes about, where beside Mesopotamia and Egypt, writing system is from the same time. It has contributed to ideas that are even today with us via Greek into English or other ways, such as the idea of a beautiful garden, which in Old Persian is paradisa, which enters through the Bible with the idea of paradise. These Persians wear clothes or that was different from everybody else. For example, their trousers, which is in Old Persian pajamaka, became pajamas that you wear. And I see many now in the classroom wearing it.
Of course.
So there's a host of things that actually comes out from this civilization and from its many layers in history.
And how far back does the idea of Persia or the Persian civilization go?
So if we're studying the history of this Iranian plateau where the Persians are going to create their empire, almost 7,000 years ago, we have clear architectural and material culture evidence from pottery. Now, the Persian speakers were part of the Iranian-speaking world. They end up onto the Iranian plateau at the end of the second millennium BC. And by the middle of the first millennium BC, they're going to establish the largest empire in antiquity, which is the Persian Empire.
So that was about 3,000 years ago.
Yes, 2,600 years ago.
So then there were a succession of Persian empires, correct?
Yes, there are. And this is one of the interesting factors about this Persian or Iranian civilization is that throughout history, it's been able to reinvent itself and create empires. Mm. It's not a one-off empire that comes. It's consistently has shown itself to be a force.
Are there things that all of those empires had in common?
It has various layers. And all of these layers, and each layer has contributed, it's been like a building block upon the other to create a worldview, a vision, be it through many religious traditions that is encountered and adopted, ideological and political.
I understand that kind of pluralism, diversity within the Persian Empire is a hallmark.
Yes. I don't want to get into politics. I just was watching the news. One of the 14 synagogues in Tehran was just bombed by probably the Israeli or American jets. And the chief rabbi had just come in to see what's left of it and the Torah. In the midst of this war, you still see, for example, a Jewish rabbi in the middle of the city. I think that is telling of this multi-ethnic civilization, even if you have a government that is so ideological. If we look in the past, already from the early Achaemenid Persian Empire rock reliefs and inscriptions, this is, for example, Darius the Great, the greatest of these Persian kings in the 6th century BCE, he uses a term in Old Persian, it's called Vispadana. It means many people. What he says is, I am the king of this earth, far and wide. I am the king of many people. And then he goes on to show every single ethnic group of this many people that are holding this empire. And there's actually, for the first time in history, that an empire is telling us that is not based on a single or sole ethnic group, but rather a conglomeration of people.
And the empire contained Greeks, Egyptians, Central Asian ethnic groups, a lot of different groups of people.
Yes, 24 to 26 people,
wow,
depending. It had as many Greeks fighting for the Persian Empire than against the Greeks.
That's interesting because there is this narrative threaded through a lot of history that features the Greeks representing the West against an antagonistic Persia representing the East. Can you tell me more about that narrative? Where does it come from? How deep-seated is that?
Sure. Obviously, as I said, there's this great empire with 24 to 26 satrapies or provinces. It's the giant. It's the behemoth of this sort of ancient world. And you have a number of Greek city-states who actually become much more connected and unified because there's this giant in front of them. So in a way, creating Greek even identity is vis-a-vis this empire. Now, it's interesting that the idea of nationalism per se is not in existence. And so when you have an empire, it brings the best. And what the Persians did is, of course, they had lots of mercenary forces. And according to my colleague, Professor Robert Rohlinger in Innsbruck, it seems that there were probably as many Greeks fighting in the Persian army or even more against the Greek city-states. So that is the reality. But what the Greek texts tell us, of course, it's their narrative of seeing this giant empire, is to say that how a group of city-states were able to fend off this huge Oriental empire with all of its sort of tropes and trappings, that the way they describe this empire, which needs to be, of course, unpacked. And from then on, whoever read these Greek texts, when you read Herodotus, this dichotomy is clear. And then when Europe, I think, really in the 17th, 18th century, when classics, the ancient world becomes important, that idea is imported and then becomes really important as an ideological tool when the Europeans are fighting the Ottoman Turks. And so you could now place the Oriental as the Ottoman, but in the same way, they're the same as the Achaemenid Persians. And this dichotomy of East and West, I think, comes into being.
I'm speaking with Turaj Deryi, director of the Center for Persian Studies at University of California, Irvine. And you're saying that was written, or that idea, that dichotomy was written by Greek historians like Herodotus, the father of history as we know him?
Yes. Herodotus writes it and the Greek historians tell the story, and sometimes they tell it in heroic manner, as every people would do of telling their narratives. And then it's picked up by the Europeans in the past 200-300 years with the rise of Europe, Western civilization, as it's called.
So that idea of East versus West takes hold in what we would call the West, at least, it sounds like. I want to talk about how that narrative plays out today in modern day Iran, or you can tell me if it doesn't. And I have a piece of tape from late last year in Tehran of crowds gathering to celebrate a new statue they want to play for a second. So these are crowds at the statue of a pre-Islamic emperor on a horse with a Roman emperor kneeling before him.
It's Shapur the First. It's a 3rd century CE king of kings who, at least according to his narrative, was able to defeat one Roman emperor, kill another one, and capture the other.
So the statue is of the Shah on a horse with this Roman emperor kneeling in deference before him. Why does that image stir so much passion up still today?
These are the Sasanian kings. They have always been and continuously in the historical narrative of the Persians or Iranian people. And so when you want to use the past as ideology, you could go and see sort of the great moment when one Persian king defeats this Roman Empire, which seems invincible and thinks it is. And this is the moment to show that we can stand to the West. Anyone who comes towards us and tries to attack us, we will defend ourselves and put them back into their place.
So you said that is a political reading or being used as political imagery, something like that today.
Absolutely.
You explained how this might impact how the regime is thinking right now. What about ordinary Iranians? Can you give us some insight into how this history might impact how they are seeing the current conflict?
Sure. The current conflict, actually the community, as I see it, is quite fractured. There are people that are very much nationalist, and they want to withstand the West under any circumstances. They're not really religious, but they may be. Then there are, of course, those who are with the supporters of the regime directly. And of course, they have much more Islamist tendency. And so that is also added to this sort of Western encroachment. And those people, of course, have made another group of people so unhappy within Iran because of the way that the government has run, its mismanagement, its ideology, that they actually see the West as a possible savior. I should say that we can see in the past month or so that many of these people who had such an idea, I think their hopes are being dashed as things are being bombed. And so they can probably see that that was not the way to change anything.
Last week, UNESCO raised concerns over the fate of Iran's World Heritage sites amid the war. Can you talk to me about the threats to culturally important sites right now?
So far, there's between 110 to 132 sites that have either been directly hit or indirectly damaged. And that is, of course, quite disconcerting. Many of these are UNESCO sites, World Heritage sites that are being struck.
What would it mean to lose this history? I understand that monuments, for example, are especially important to Persian history because there's less of a written record.
Absolutely. You're quite right. And of course, these days, people read less and less. So these monuments become locations of memory, what I call the sort of locus of memory. And so you go to the palace in Tehran, Gulistan Palace, which began in the Zand period in the 18th century. The palace has been hit. Its mirror work, which are 19th century mirror work color, have been broken. The throne is damaged. It's really, as an Iranian American, I feel heartbroken because it shows the breaking of some sort of symbolic sovereignty. You can't rebuild these. We can't say, I'm going to go to IKEA and get some wood and buy some glasses from China and I'm going to put this together.
Turaj Deryi is the director of the Center for Persian Studies at University of California, Irvine. You're listening to The World.
Hi, I'm Joey Akin. And if you care about African music beyond just the hits, I'd love to invite you into something deeper. Afrobeat Intelligence is the podcast extension of my newsletter. Each week, I examine the trends, the people, and the process behind the sound with guests like Tiwa Savage, Lojay, Ruga, and Sars. Join us as we unpack how Afrobeats became a global cultural force. Subscribe to Afrobeats Intelligence on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, or wherever you listen.
This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Here's an odd one for you. Over the past 3 years in India, huge mechanical elephants have started appearing in temples across the country. The life-size replicas actually move. They've been paid for by animal rights organizations to stop temples from using real elephants for rituals. Some say the public is embracing a move away from animal cruelty, but others say it's simply the work of activist organizations with deep pockets. Reporter Jamie Fullerton went to Kerala in South India, the heartland of temple elephant culture, to learn more.
Oh, I can stick my head in the actual cave. I'm inside an elephant.
Prasanth Prakashan has invited me to stick my head inside a mechanical elephant's stomach in his workshop in rural Kerala. There's a metal piston just in front of my nose, and it's making the mechanical pachyderm's tail swish from side to side.
Move his head? Huh. Head, ear, eyes, tail.
What's his name?
He can spray water also. Yeah, his name not yet decided.
Okay.
Prakashan is an artist and model creator and has about 25 employees at the Mechanical Elephant Workshop. The team is busy painting rubber tails, testing eyes that look back and forward, and pulling ropes to make big wobbly grey trunks swing upwards. The animal rights organization PETA buys Prakashan's incredibly lifelike, life-size mechanical elephants and donates them to Hindu temples in India to replace real elephants used in ceremonies. In Kerala, elephants have been important for Hindu rituals for centuries and are believed to bring blessings. People ride them in temples and dress the animals in golden headwear. PETA says it's cruel and needs to end.
They purchase from us and they're gifted to the temple also.
Yeah.
The intention is free the real elephants.
Prakashan's team push a big mechanical elephant onto the back of a truck, then drive down dirt tracks past lush greenery to a nearby village temple. A few hundred villagers have come out for the new temple mechanical elephants unveiling ceremony. As well as paying for the robot, PETA has laid on vegan food for the locals. The mechanical elephant is placed behind a big white sheet in the temple grounds. I see the ominous shape of its huge head and tusks behind the veil. The sheet is pulled aside, revealing the imposing mechanical creature. Its head is covered in gold ceremonial headwear and starts moving from side to side as a man throws petals at it. Many temple goers believe that the animals are praying when real elephants move their heads like this. PETA claims that actually, it's a sign of distress. The mechanical elephant's legs can't move. Some guys at the temple push it on a set of wheels and make it do a lap of the temple. The villagers chant and nod their heads towards the fiberglass and rubber pachyderm. Temple authorities here signed an agreement with PETA to not use real elephants anymore. Now they've been given this one for free.
When we started this in 2023, it was the first elephant in Kerala and across India. But right now, at least 26 mechanical elephants in South India are now using the in temples across South India.
Ujwal Agrain is a senior policy advisor with PETA India. He came down from Delhi to speak at the temple unveiling.
Until last year, at this place, there used to be real elephants.
There are around 400 captive elephants in Kerala, out of around 2,500 in India. That count of 400 captive elephants is down by almost half since 2010, generally due to tighter restrictions on owning elephants for shows and ceremonies. Agrain says that the rising popularity of mechanical elephants isn't just down to the declining supply of real elephants. He says the public is coming around to the idea that keeping elephants chained up in temples under punishing sunlight is immoral.
And now we see these mechanical elephants used in election processions. We are seeing it used in wildlife sanctuaries for the elephant rites. We are now even seeing it being used in the marriages, the wedding functions. So there is a change in how people see it, both in terms of business and second in terms of empathy and culture.
What do you guys think of the elephants? Good?
Yes.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Okay. As good as real elephants or not?
Almost.
Almost.
In the temple, Anita Chavun is watching the mechanical elephant flap its ears. She tells me it's realistic and 80% good. Just not quite there.
Because for many ages, we have been with real elephant. So we got that feel of real elephant.
Yeah. Mm. You miss it or?
Yeah.
Mechanical elephants may not be quite as awe-inspiring as the real thing, but one benefit is that they don't attack people. In 2025, an elephant killed one person and injured 24 people at a religious festival in Kerala. The animal was filmed picking a man up by the leg with its trunk and hurling him. Ashok Kumar is the priest at a smaller nearby temple. His brother owns a mechanical elephant that he rents to other temples. Kumar says Peter is trying to impinge outsider values on Kerala's elephant traditions.
It's an outside influence. Kerala is following this elephant procession and all. That's a different culture. So they are trying to destroy that culture, I'm sure.
How many robot elephants have you made?
And now around it's been... For 3 years, I think more than 50 numbers I have delivered.
50? Yeah.
Suraj Nambiat is another robot elephant artist. He and Prasanth Prakashan, whose workshop I visited earlier, are the two main mechanical elephant creators in Kerala.
It's maybe a responsibility that, you know, I'm getting from the God.
Nambiat used to mainly make elephant models and sculptures, but recently focused his business on mechanical elephants due to rising demand. He says he's had threats from temple goers who see his work as endangering Kerala tradition. He calls the people who make these threats elephant maniacs.
Whenever they see me, that won't be good to me. There are a lot of threats that will stop this. Otherwise, we will be, damage your workshop.
They said they damaged your workshop.
Yeah, sure.
Nambiat has only sold a couple of robot elephants to Peter. He focuses on businesses and private buyers who rent the mechanical creatures out for weddings and other ceremonies. Although he has to avoid temple festivals due to threats from elephant maniacs, Nambiat says that with captive elephant numbers declining in India, it's inevitable that mechanical elephants will fill the gap.
These same people will come to me and Prashant to make... their favorite elephant. They will, I think they will ask me why that elephant. So I'm waiting for that time.
Until that day comes, artists like Nambiat and Prakashan will concentrate on developing their mechanical elephants. They both say they're working on models that can walk. For The World, I'm Jamie Fullerton in Kerala.
More global stories coming your way. Stick around. You're with The World. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Taiwan's firebrand opposition leader Cheng Li-woon has touched down in China today on a rare visit. She arrived at the invitation of President Xi Jinping in what she's calling a journey for peace. The visit comes as the war in Iran fuels concern in Taiwan that U.S. focus and resources may be stretched, leaving the island more exposed. To learn more, we reached out to William Yang, a senior analyst with Crisis Group. He's in Taiwan's capital, Taipei. Yang told me Taiwan is watching events in Iran with unease.
the disruption of energy supply has prompted Taiwan's government to really scramble and try to find alternative energy sources. And this will continue to be a long-term, mid to long-term struggle for Taiwan, as it actually imports about 97% of its energy overall. And, you know, I think on the other hand, it is very wary about the possible lessons that China is likely going to take away from this war, especially observing how Iran has effectively wield its control over the Strait of Hormuz to turn it somewhat into a little bit of its advantage. And China might actually take it as an inspiration to do similar things in the Taiwan Strait. And at a time when, in fact, the Chinese military is so much more powerful than the Iranian military in terms of its capabilities and the technology, I think this is certainly something that will occupy a lot of the minds of Taiwanese officials and Taiwanese people here at the moment.
And William, is the war raising concerns in Taiwan about U.S. attention span and military capabilities, with a lot of it focused on the Persian Gulf right now, whether the U.S. can fight in the Middle East while deterring China?
Yes, exactly. I think that's also a concern that's been weighing on Taiwanese government's mind as of late. And to be clear, I think the concern is shared by all U.S. allies across Asia, from South Korea to Japan and all the way down to the Philippines. The longer that the U.S. gets entangled up in the Middle East, and also the likelihood that the U.S. continues to move assets and also facing ammunition depletion in its air bombardment against Iran, I think the greater this concern is going to be. And for Taipei, it is particularly sensitive and also tricky issue because, again, it is not an official treaty ally to the United States. And also its defense relationship with other neighbors is very murky and also unofficial. So Taiwan will feel a lot more exposed at this time and be very wary of any potential military buildup that China might actually undertake in the near future.
As I mentioned, Chung Li-woon arrived in China today. She is the combative chair of Taiwan's main opposition party, the KMT, the Kuomintang. She's hoping to meet China's leader, Xi Jinping, in Beijing. This sort of visit, we have to say, is rare. Why is it happening now?
The timing is really being determined by the Chinese side. You know, it comes about a month before Trump is supposed to visit Beijing for his rescheduled summit with Xi Jinping. And the Chinese side, I think, sees an opportunity to host Chung Li-woon as a very important geopolitical signaling, both to Taipei, but also to Washington. Chung Li-woon has been known for being a very prominent voice opposing Taiwanese government's attempt to dramatically increase Taiwan's defense spending, pursued upon the pressure coming from the Trump administration. But now that Beijing is hosting her, is likely sending a signal to Trump personally, but also Washington in general, that China has its own communication channel with a political leader that is willing to align her position and policy closely to China's official narrative. And China is likely going to use this to put pressure on Trump and say, look, we potentially can work with other political powers in Taiwan that are potentially against your pressure campaign on Taiwan to increase its defense budget. So why don't we sit down for you to consider taking on our objection to the longstanding U.S. arms support for Taiwan. You know, we can't just rule out the fact that Trump might, in fact, be willing to consider this demand coming from the Chinese side.
Well, apparently there is debate right now in the Taiwanese parliament and, in fact, within Chung's own party, the KMT, over dependability on the U.S. when it comes to military defense. Like, Taiwan has a deal with Washington for U.S. weapon systems, but they're basically on back order and not arriving. So can Chung's trip to Beijing also be seen as military window shopping?
That also could very well be the case. Her party's opposition to the $40 billion defense budget has largely been because of the serious backlog that Taiwan is facing in terms of the U.S. delivery of the weapons that Taiwan has already purchased. And at the same time, the general lack of predictability coming from the Trump administration in terms of where it stands on its policy toward Taiwan. And because of the transactional nature of the Trump administration's foreign policy, it really creates an opening for her to argue that Taiwan should perhaps consider also resuming or shifting more of its focus to resuming dialogue and exchange with China so that it can reduce its vulnerability of relying too much on the United States at a time when Washington's commitment or credibility is in fact in doubt.
I'm speaking with William Yong, a senior analyst with Crisis Group in Taipei, about what's happening with Taiwan and China as the war in Iran grinds on with global repercussions. William, I'm just really curious about the Kuomintang, the KMT, the party of Madam Chung. How popular is it in Taiwan today? I mean, it is kind of historic, isn't it?
It has long been a ruling party up until, I think, 2016, and then they lost consecutive three presidential elections. But despite the consecutive loss in the presidential elections, this party still holds about 35 to 40% of public approval rating. So that's not too little. And they still, you know, I think hold enough influence in Taiwan's public space, especially at the local level across the country. They hold about 2/3 of the local seats and local offices across Taiwan. So, you know, I think it will be interesting to see how Chung's trip plays out, how it's being received and viewed in Taiwan, and what she actually says after coming back to Taiwan. But because, in fact, she now is also contemplating a potential trip to the United States. So, you know, despite the fact that she's been prioritizing going to China over the last few months, she is also now recalibrating a little bit, sensing the uneasiness that is arising and emerging within Taiwan, but also within her own political party about her attempt to try to align more closer to China. So if that's the case, and she's able to really recalibrate back to a position where she's trying to thread a needle between the United States and China, that's actually not necessarily going to be too damaging to her party's prospects going forward in the upcoming elections.
So with Chung Li-Woon and some members of the KMT supporting closer ties with mainland China, I'm wondering how the average Taiwanese see that. Do they support it?
I think it's a mixed view. Again, you know, they certainly don't want the both sides of the Taiwan Strait to go without any possible way to communicate with each other, which has been the case since 2016. But at the same time, they're very wary about China seizing onto this momentum and try to further use that to pressure and force Taiwan to potentially make more concessions that will allow China to facilitate its mission of reunification with Taiwan.
So, William, let's get back to what you raised a moment ago, what Beijing is seeing with what's going on in Iran and the choke point that is the Strait of Hormuz. What lesson is China taking about the pivotal role of another strait, the Taiwan Strait?
China obviously will be paying close attention to how Iran has really used its control over the Strait of Hormuz. China already is paving the foundation for increasing its de facto control over the Taiwan Strait with its Coast Guard exercises and the frequent maritime incursions across the median line of the Taiwan Strait to establish a new normal that effectively it can impose control over the Taiwan Strait in the name of law enforcement. Iran's imposing a de facto blockade over the Strait of Hormuz is only going to further strengthen China's belief that what it has been doing is indeed in the right direction. And control over maritime choke point is, in fact, a very powerful weapon that now it also possesses to try to pressure the United States.
So just looking a couple of months down the road, William, President Trump was originally slated to meet with Xi Jinping in late March. The visit was postponed due to the U.S. war with Iran. It may happen now in mid-May. How has the Iran war changed expectations for that meeting, do you think?
I think the bandwidth of the U.S. foreign policy apparatus has obviously now been all fixated on the war in the Middle East and trying to find an off-ramp to extract the U.S. And that is really occupying and squeezing the government's ability to really focus on the pre-summit preparation and meetings with their Chinese counterpart. And the Chinese side is slightly on happy about that because they were hoping they would have enough face time with their U.S. counterpart before the summit to be able to iron out the details that both leaders then can sign off and declare victory to their own domestic audience. But on the other hand, I think with a very distracted United States, that actually allows China to have more time to strengthen its own hand and also firm up its own agenda, including its list of demands, so that when the two leaders meet, Xi Jinping will be very well prepared to put China's position and demands on the table. I think the Chinese side will be betting on the fact that the U.S. will not have enough bandwidth to be able to handle any unexpected surprises that China might actually be able to put onto the table.
William Yang is a senior analyst with Crisis Group. He joined us from Taiwan's capital, Taipei.
In the UK right now, proposed reforms to the legal system are being hotly debated. The government there is determined to press ahead with plans to scrap jury trials for thousands of criminal cases in England and Wales. Under the plans, offences likely to carry sentences of 3 years or less would be heard by a judge alone. Ministers say the change will help tackle the backlog of 80,000 cases in the Crown Court. But as Nick Martin reports, the proposals have triggered strong opposition. Lawyers and judges warn against the erosion of a right long seen as a cornerstone of the British judicial system.
Stand, please.
The justice system in England and Wales is at breaking point.
If you're a barrister practicing in the Crown Court, over the last few years, you've got used to nothing working. There's no expectation anymore that a case will start on time.
Kirsty Brimelow, KC, chair of the Bar Council of England and Wales, sums up the deep frustration felt right across the court system because of a huge backlog of cases. Today, nearly 80,000 cases are waiting in the Crown Court, more than double the number before the pandemic.
This is the first case on your list, FC 2673459 8, and is the matter of Wessex County Council and Lowe.
The government, led by Justice Secretary David Lammy, insists the reforms will free up thousands of hearing days for the most serious cases, such as murder and rape, while still preserving jury trials where longer sentences are likely. Ministers argue that without change, the backlog could reach 200,000 by 2035. Critics, however, say independent analysis shows that moving to judge-only trials would deliver only marginal time savings. They insist that real solutions lie in funding, recruiting more judges and barristers, reopening closed courts, and fixing failing technology. Brimelow warns that removing judges could damage public trust, especially in cases involving minority groups.
Jury trials are effectively the only part of the criminal justice system where any prejudices are balanced out, whereas other parts of the criminal justice system have been shown to be damaged by prejudices, and particularly towards minority groups. And so if you take away a jury and a defendant is convicted by a single judge, there might be a lack of trust in that conviction.
Your Worships, at this point I'd like to make an application for Mr. Hudson to remain in court throughout the duration of the proceedings.
For victims, the court delays can be agonising. Rape survivors often wait more than 400 days, sometimes well over 18 months for a trial to begin. Many describe the pain of being unable to move on with their lives or simply choose to withdraw from the process altogether. Defendants also suffer. Those on bail can wait years before their names are cleared or their guilt confirmed. Those held in custody on remand can spend months, sometimes longer, in prison awaiting trial, only for charges to be dropped or reduced later. Such is the strong feeling in the legal profession that solicitors, barristers, King's Counsel, retired judges, and a former director of public prosecutions have signed the Bar Council's open letter urging the Prime Minister to abandon the plan. The letter states, "We do not support the erosion of a deeply entrenched constitutional principle for negligible gain and with substantial risks." The proposals were the subject of a heated debate in Parliament earlier this month, with MPs from all sides clashing over the right balance between clearing the courts and protecting long-standing legal rights. Safeguarding Minister Jess Phillips, herself a victim of the court's backlog, gave the reforms her full support. She revealed that a man accused of breaching a restraining order against her will not face trial until 2028, and said the court system is too often used by perpetrators to control victims. But even within her ruling Labour Party, there is unease. Charlotte Nicholls, MP for Warrington North, has waived her right to anonymity after being raped at a work event. She told Parliament that the government's framing of the debate has troubled her.
We have been told that if we have concerns about this bill, it is because we have not been raped or because we don't care enough for rape victims. The opposite is true in my case. It is because I have been raped that I'm as passionate as I am about what it means for a justice system to be truly victim focused. It is because I have endured every indignity that our broken criminal justice system could mete out that I care what kind of reform will actually deliver justice for survivors and victims of crime.
Although the government insists the plans are strictly limited to lower-level crimes likely to attract sentences of 3 years or less, legal experts fear mission creep. They warn that once the principle of trial by jury is removed, even for these cases, it could gradually be extended to more serious offences in the future. One of the most powerful critics of the change is former Conservative Attorney General Sir Geoffrey Cox, KC.
It must be a non-ideological space, the administration of justice. And jury trial unites us all for a simple reason. It is the most powerful instrument and engine of social justice that this country has ever invented. Yeah. It is a safeguard against oppression. It is a built-in defence against establishment and administrative power.
The Courts and Tribunals Bill has cleared its second reading in the House of Commons, despite some Labour rebellions. Whether it survives further scrutiny may depend on whether ministers can convince Parliament and the public that faster justice justifies limiting a right long regarded as a cornerstone of the British legal system.
Nick Martin there reporting for DW's Inside Europe podcast. Still to come, we stop by a haven for comic book fans in Madrid. You are listening to The World. This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Fans of manga, the Japanese comics genre, consider this film a classic. The 1988 Japanese hit Akira is about a boy and a scientific experiment gone wrong. The movie helped fuel the manga craze in the West. It's also the name of and inspiration for a comics store in Madrid. It was just named the best in the world for the second time. The World's Jerry Haddon took us inside Akira Comics last fall.
The old adage, don't judge a book by its cover, it applies to comics too. And who'd have thunk it? To comics readers. The first person I approach inside Akira is a middle-aged mom. Her 9-year-old son is dragging her along by the hand. Could I ask the boy what comics he likes? I ask her. She laughs. I'm the comics fan, she says. I love graphic novels, says Nazaret Garcia, but I also like classic superhero comics. I go from one extreme to the other. Because you can in Akira Comics. It has everything from manga to the Marvel Universe to fantasy literature. Garcia says she only shops here, even though in Madrid there are several other comic stores. Because it's a fantasy land, she says, you become immersed in another world, or worlds, plural. Akira is like no other comic store on Earth, which is partly why it won Best on Earth at this year's Comic-Con in San Diego. Comic-Con is the biggest yearly comics industry gathering. Walk around the 9,000-square-foot Akira store, the largest in the world, and you'll soon find a life-size facade of a hobbit house. It's a replica of Bilbo Baggins' place from The Lord of the Rings, round wooden door and all. Instead of using all of our wall space for comics books, says Akira co-owner Jesus Marugan, we decided to do something no business person in their right mind would do. That is, waste prime retail space on not-for-sale decorations. But since we're bona fide weirdos, he says proudly, we took the weird route. And actually, he says, when people saw the Hobbit house, they were like, whoa, what is that? And that's how it all started. Where it will end, Marugan has no idea. On a quick tour of Akira, I nearly trip over it to scale replica of R2-D2, the beeping droid from Star Wars. Two of the columns holding up the store's second floor, once transformed into a magical glowing tree, the other the twisting green beanstalk a certain Jack once climbed. As for the upstairs, for the moment it's cordoned off. The stairs are blocked right now, Marugan says, as we finish our European cathedral. For those unfamiliar with comics, he says, it's to let them know they're in the European section for sci-fi, fantasy, and steampunk literature. When done, the walls and ceiling up there will appear as vaulted stone arches, replete with gargoyles in the form of Yoda, the Star Wars Jedi Master, and Stitch, the Disney alien. But by far, Akira's largest section is devoted to Japanese manga. A street sign at the start of a long corridor reads, Neo Tokyo District. The area is adorned with red Japanese lanterns.
Yo creo que es público que le gusta nuestra forma de ser y de pensar.
Our clients really like our style, the way we think, says Marugan. We put our soul into this place. We leave a trace of our essence in everything we do, he says. Clients recognize that, he says, and are drawn to the positive vibe, the helpful staff, and a selection of over 60,000 comics and books to browse through. For serious collectors like Madrid college student Alejandro Caraza, it's a place where rare gems appear. For example, he says, we just saw an exclusive limited edition of the Wolverine from Marvel's The X-Men. They're always getting new and rare stuff in. You need to be on the ball, he says, and get here fast. Otherwise, things sell out. As to getting here, it does take some effort. Akira Comics is located in Madrid's far north, and during the week, it only opens from 5 to 7:30 p.m. One woman complains to a clerk that she and her kid have been coming by day after day, only to find the store closed. Which might explain why, before opening, the sidewalk outside is filled with comics lovers waiting to get in. Among them, a young office worker named Maria Serrano, who traveled an hour and a half on the subway from the far south of the city. We came all this way just for this, she says. It's our third try. My boyfriend and I are creating a shelf at home to display all of our various Marvel Comics editions, and we hope to find more. And then Akira's doors open, and Serrano and the others rush inside. Each into a world of their own choosing. For the world, I'm Jerry Haddon, Madrid, Spain.
In the beginning, years before they were part of Paul Simon's Graceland, they were a family ensemble consisting of Shabalalas and Mazibukos. I'm referring to the legendary South African choir Ladysmith Black Mambazo, founded by singer Joseph Shabalala in 1960 in the KwaZulu-Natal province town of Ladysmith. An early lineup included Shabalala and several of his siblings, plus two brothers, Milton and Albert Mazibuko, who also happened to be cousins of the Shabalalas.
As the early members passed away, new singers took their place. We have now learned that a long-serving member of the ensemble, Albert Mazibuko, has died. He sang with the group for 55 years. Nansi Amali means there is money, and the song offers thoughts for the many poor South Africans who work in the diamond mines there.
Halala team leaders.
These days, Ladysmith Black Mambazo tours with the descendants of the Mazibuko and Shabalala families. Even a grandson of the late founder, Joseph Shabalala, has gigged with the group. They've been on a U.S. tour scheduled to wrap up this Friday, in fact. A few years ago, when Albert Mazibuko was in his late 60s, he was featured in a short documentary about Ladysmith and had this simple statement about why this traditional sound made with family and friends was so important to him.
The deeper the root, the stronger the tree. We must not forget our past and family, where we come from.
Albert Mazibuko was 77. He died Sunday. The World is produced by GBH and PRX, broadcasting weekdays from the Nan and Bill Harris studio in Boston and from the Department of Communication at UC San Diego. Find us online anytime at theworld.org and check out more of our original reporting on YouTube. We are at The World News GBH. I'm Carolyn Beeler.
And I'm Marco Werman. Join us right back here tomorrow.
The World is supported by the Carnegie Corporation of New York, working to reduce political polarization through philanthropic support for education, democracy, and peace. More information at carnegie.org. By the Lumina Foundation, committed to a fair, universal system for learning beyond high school that offers every American the chance for a better life. LuminaFoundation.org. By the PRX Ambassador Council, whose members include Judy Pigott, the Gruber Family Foundation, the Schmidt Family Foundation, and Gavin Salmanese, LLC. The World's theme music is composed by Ned Porter. The World is a co-production of GBH Boston and PRX.